Oh, there we go. So Eric's going to do the hard part. I'm going to do the easy part. Okay, so our topic is Generation Y Transformational Leadership and Shifting Public Health Paradigms. Can everybody hear me? Okay. We have absolutely nothing to disclose.
But if anybody has any financial relationships they want to start with me, I'm more than willing.
Me too. okay, and here's our roadmap for today. We're going to give you a brief introduction on what we're planning on doing with this project. And for those of us that are new to public health, we're going to quickly go through current priorities for local health departments. It wasn't actually until I got to my first APHA that I even heard of these things, even though I was in a program. Okay, so then we're going to talk about shifts in funding sources that we've seen over the last 20 years. Just a real quick snapshot of the current public health workforce, and when we talk about this, we're talking specifically about local health departments, not state level. And then a few tidbits on the generations and expectations of different generations, and particularly Generation Y. And then, again, a real quick down and dirty introduction to the concept of transformational leadership, and then some suggestions we might have for the reconceiving things. Okay, so first off, generally speaking, local health departments tend to be reactive to changes in the macro environment. And what I mean by the macro environment is things like economic changes, changes in sociocultural issues in the country, including demographics, as well as cultural changes, and so on. At this point, there are two major transitions going on. First, in funding structures, and second, in workforce demographics. And this is broadly speaking, not specific to public health workforce, but workforce demographics in general. And this, we're suggesting we have an opportunity in local health departments to be a bit proactive in the way we do things so that we can ensure provision of service and perhaps even improve provision of service just by rethinking a little bit what we're doing. Okay, so current priorities, core functions, assessment, assurance, policy development, and here are the real snapshots of what those mean for those of you that might not be quite so familiar with them. And then essential services, monitor, diagnose, and investigate, inform, educate, and empower. Additional services. We are particularly focused on this assuring a competent workforce so that we can provide that service that we're supposed to as public health workers. All right, Eric's turn.
And just a little bit more background. My job is as research and policy director for the City of Milwaukee Health Department, and it's a relatively new position. It's almost like I'm the resident academic, so I get to do a lot of studies and looking at broader trends in public health. And in doing so, if anybody works in local public health, these trends might look familiar. This data is taken from the NACHO Local Public Health Survey. And as you can see, local health departments, regardless of size, have seen a decrease in the amount that they receive from their local property tax levy, starting at 34% of their annual budget in 1992, and that has dropped to 25% in 2008. State and federal pass-throughs have also seen a slight decrease in that time, while there has been an increase in licensing and personal fees for service. So we're not getting as big a share of the pie in terms of property taxes, so we're having to increase the fees that we charge for restaurant licensing, home inspections, things of that nature. Federal grants and contracts awarded directly to local health departments, there was a sharp decrease from 2005 to 2008. There was a pretty steady decrease in the amount of federal grants, especially competitive grants available in the previous decade. As we put this together, we of course the stimulus bill and healthcare reform bill had not come to fruition yet, so the jury's still out on how funding will impact local health departments, but I can tell you in our state of Wisconsin, most of the money has been awarded to universities or the state government, and it hasn't trickled its way down to our communities yet. Other private foundations and Insurance, private insurance, that has been up and down inconsistent, while Medicare and Medicaid reimbursement has been increasing steadily over that time. So again, we're getting less property tax revenue, and we're having to bill people for the services that we provide. I will now hand it back to Maureen.
So I'm going to guess a lot of you are familiar with the numbers in terms of retirements and so on, 20% retirement eligible in 5 years. And again, this is local health departments, not state. In the state of Wisconsin, it's a much greater percentage when we go at the state level. I think it's up to 50%, Eric?
50% by
2012?
A little bit later, like 2018.
Oh, okay. So we've got lots of folks ready to retire. Also, 90% of local health department officers are boomers or Gen Xers, and that's pretty consistent, obviously makes sense given what's going on. Now, our boomers, we have 78 million people that fall into the baby boom generation, okay? This is 26% of our population. And some of the generalizations we can make about those folks, and this is not across the board, because I fall into this category, and not all of these apply to me. So again, they're generalizations. But this group tends to like to micromanage, okay, They dislike laziness. You know, you got to work hard to get where you want to go, according to the boomer literature. They believe that you have to pay dues to earn respect and to earn some a position of authority in your local health department. And they seek consensus when making decisions. That's our boomers. So keep some of those in mind as we move forward to talking about our Gen Ys. If we go with Gen X, these are those of you out there who are between 30 and 45. You constitute a mere 16% of the population based on a U.S. population of 300 million. Gen X folks are willing to take risks. These are the guys that pushed for some little bit of work-life balance, looking at the boomers saying, you guys are crazy for working all those hours. So they were pushing, and they paved the way for people in the future to have more balance in their work life. They also tend to emphasize collaboration and teamwork. And quality of life is important, i.e. that work-life balancing. They are not loyal to their employer. They are loyal to careers, more likely. And again, these are generalizations. So clearly, we're going to have examples of people who don't fit the bill here. And then Gen Y. We've got people in this generation. We've got 80 million of these folks, 80 million Gen Ys. That's 27% of the population. And they are going to be out there in the workforce. They expect to progress rapidly. That is just, for them, a given. They want immediate feedback, which is really nice with the micromanaging boomers, because they can get that immediate feedback. They also, there are a couple other things here, though. They want continuous recognition, separate from feedback. They want recognition for the work that they've done. A little bit different concepts here. They don't want a manager that's saying, do this, do this, do this. They want coaches and mentors. Okay, they much prefer that kind of management. They want immediate decision-making authority. You walk in the door, and I want authority to make decisions today, even though I know nothing about your health department other than the name of it. And they, again, are loyal to careers and their professions and their ideals, not their employers, okay? They very much value work-life balance, even more so than our Gen Xs. And on any given day, if you push them, they will choose life over work if they have to make a choice, okay? One of the leadership paradigms that would be, potentially useful to managing this group of workers is something called transformational leadership. And there are a host of different models for transformational leadership. But they tend to all have this idea of inspiring followers to forego self-interest. So this leader has to be an inspirational kind of person. They also recognize that leadership is not about power. And a lot of people equate being a leader with being powerful. And that is not the case. That is not the mindset or the assumptions brought into transformational leadership. It is about relationships and fostering positive working relationships. Okay. There are several different models, but there are common elements to those models. Future orientation is very important, so a shared vision for where the health department is going. Okay. And that is communicated widely throughout the organization. It's not something that's kept at the, you know, executive leadership team or whomever that is running the show. It's shared. And influence orientation. And to capture this, fundamentally, it's about empowering team members. It's giving them that authority those Gen Ys are craving. There's also a people orientation. Show real respect for individuals is the idea behind this transformational leadership models. Respect for individuals, give them individual consideration so that they can do their work. Also, encouraging creativity. Governmental agencies tend to have rather bureaucratic structures, and quite often bureaucratic structures aren't the best playground for inspiring creativity, although there are ways that we can do this. That is very important when we talk about transformational leadership, inspiring creativity. And then a values orientation, being open and trustful. Okay, the leaders need to be open with their employees, and they need to be trusting and trustable. Okay. So there's some, in the literature, we've got some positive correlations between transformational leadership models and things like organizational commitment, something that we want to develop in our Gen Ys since they aren't particularly loyal to organizations. If we can build organizational commitment, our investment in them will come back to us. Another positive correlation is with job satisfaction and with organizational support. They'll provide support to the organization. Negative correlations, if you have the more transformational leadership behaviors that are displayed, the less likely you're going to have job-related stress. That stress is going to go down. Negative correlation also is with burnout. Burnout goes down with transformational leadership as the way to rally the troops. And then training outcomes. There's some research that shows that transformational managers that get transformational leadership training actually become more effective communicators. And I'm going to guess most of you have heard one of the things is, oh, they don't communicate very well with us. And then greater job clarity and greater empowerment for mid-level management when it comes to transformational leadership skills and building those skills. And there is particular research in transformational leadership that shows that this paradigm is particularly useful at mid-levels in organizations. So developing leadership at the mid-levels in the organization, because they're the ones that have the direct contact with those line staff, boots on the ground workers. Okay, so from here, it's Eric's turn again.
So we've kind of been on three different areas talking about core functions and essential services, what we do on a day-to-day basis in public health. We've talked about how we've had to do more with less over the last 20 years due to budgets, and we've talked about a leadership paradigm that could be used to make those lemons and turn it into lemonade, so to speak. And one thing that we're going to have to do as public health leaders is prepare for creating an environment for that workforce, the Generation Y workforce, to succeed and be interested and make public health an attractive place to work. So what we are proposing is that the current core functions of assurance, assessment, and policy development are not meant to be replaced. But again, this perfect storm that's happening right now, and you can throw healthcare reform into the mix as what is the role of prevention going to be if you have an extra 30-some million people on private insurance through the exchanges? Are they still going to need public health services? These are all questions that have to be answered. So in the last couple of years, us at the Milwaukee Health Department have conducted an assessment of community stakeholders using the MAP process from NACHO. And from that process, we convened 9 different teams to focus on different action areas in the community, like maternal and child health, AODA issues, STDs, built environment, etc. And we had they gave us, as a leadership team working on this project, each about three or so statements related to what, in an ideal world, they would like to implement in the community, in public health community. And we took their feedback home over a weekend, and myself, as a in the last third of the Gen X group, and a couple of our population health fellows who are definitely Gen Yers, came back to work on Monday and had, as we qualitatively looked through these 36, 37 different ideal action statements, came to the same conclusion about how we would like to see the future of public health unfold in the United States. And so think of these not as eliminating what we do, but as a lens to look at the essential services and core functions into the future. One is to address health equity. As Maureen said, the Generation Y aged folks are really set in their ideals. They are an idealistic bunch. Much of that was evidenced by the presidential election in 2008, and they turned out in record numbers in that age group to vote. So they have a voice. We also saw what happens when they don't come out and vote, and that happened last week. So they have ideals, and they are really seeing inequities in society as something that needs to be addressed. It's not okay to have big disparities in teen pregnancy rates and STDs. It just makes no sense that this actually exists. So taking a look at managing your public health office through the concept of health equity is important. And really, this is a chance for local public health to be a voice and to be an advocate for those that are suffering from health disparities. You know, in 20 years, if healthcare reform stays on track, in theory, there might not be a need for us to do tens of thousands of immunizations at a free clinic if everybody has insurance and a medical home and can see a doctor on an annual or semi-annual basis. So that leaves us as public health officials to say, what can we do in addition to or in lieu of these direct services? And advocacy and focusing on social justice and health equity is one area. Utilizing technology is another very important one. This generation, the Generation Y folks, are much more connected than any other previous generation through electronics and social media. Everybody's got Facebook and Twitter now. But one of the things that we're exploring in Milwaukee that we hope to get off the ground in the next year is setting up a text message question and answer system, so that when we do our maternal and child home visits, or we see somebody in the immunization clinic and maybe they're pregnant or they have children, we can give them a number to text in if they have questions. 24/7 you can get a response, because there's a database that can read keywords in the questions and generate a response specific to those keywords. So we might not be able to get to all their houses in a home visit. Milwaukee has 600,000 people. Maybe we can maybe see 150 people a year, but we can reach everybody if they're willing to take out their BlackBerry or iPhone and send a text message if they have health questions.
Do they all have them?
The younger generation, most of them have those types of media tools as opposed to landlines. So it's a much more...
I'm a baby boomer, so...
obviously. The use of technology is a great way to reach the younger population and make public health an attractive workplace for these young folks to work and use their skills in social marketing, social media, and communication to reach out to populations. And mobilize partnerships, which a lot of us are already doing. But in healthcare reform, partnerships are going to be the key. And if you take a look at the law, nonprofit health systems are now going to be required to do community health improvement assessments to maintain their nonprofit status. In Wisconsin, by statute, health departments, local health departments, are required to do a community health assessment every 3 to 5 years. Well, Milwaukee County has 13 health departments and 5 health systems. That's a waste of resources to have 18 different community health assessments going on at one point. So this is a chance, under the context of healthcare reform, to mobilize partnerships with our primary care and specialty care providers and do a comprehensive community assessment. and perhaps have those with the money pay for it. As we saw in the budgets, it's more and more difficult for us to do these types of things, even though we're statutorily required. And then going forward, essential services for the 21st century. Again, the young folks in this country are much more socially active and socially in tune. They grew up with the concept of global warming. They grew up with Magic Johnson always being HIV positive. You know, I'm teaching Public Health 101 right now. I have 18-year-old kids who never heard of Rock Hudson. So when I'm doing my lectures, I have to think literally their world starts in about 1995 or 2000. So the stuff that is our tried and true public health concepts and knowledge are not even on the radar for this next generation. But things that are on the radar for them are things like environmental stewardship, you know, things like cap and trade, clean air and clean water are very important to those, to that generation. It should be, it is important to all of us, but again, this is the social issues of their time that they grew up with. Responsible urban development, and this is something that is near and dear to my heart, and I led the team in our assessment that focused on this. But we're talking about walkable, bikeable cities. We're talking about transportation. When I come here to Denver, I'm jealous. I see trains and buses and things like that all over the place. And it would be wonderful to have those opportunities for everybody. In Milwaukee, they don't exist. But we are trying to look at creating more mixed income neighborhoods and using our housing authority and HUD funds to create cohesive neighborhoods where you can get access to fresh food. And maybe it's not getting another big box grocery store, but it's working with your city planners to put urban gardening into place, into new developments. Or one grant that I have pending right now would be to have a nonprofit food distributor get produce into corner stores. As opposed to trying to, you know, do the big thing all at once. Just neighborhood by neighborhood, you can affect change. Quality affordable housing. Lead safe, asthma safe, crime-free neighborhoods and housing is very important. This is something that we at the Milwaukee Health Department have worked a great deal on. In 1995, 40% of our six-year-old children and under had elevated blood lead levels. Through our lead abatement program, where we worked with contractors to remove windows and remove paint and improve the housing stock, for 2009 we got that number down to 4.5%. So something as simple as where you do your day-to-day living can have such dramatic health impacts that it seems, even when I started working at the health department 2 years ago, it was unfathomable to me that even 5% of the kids still had elevated blood lead levels, much less 40% 15 years ago. Access to health care. Again, with health care reform, the theory would be that many more millions of people will have access to health care. They'll have insurance, but will they truly have access? And I think that's where a public health agency can serve as an advocate, can be a place where people can come and get information about the future exchanges. You can work with them to get the plan that best benefits them and serve as almost like an advocate for the folks that are new to the private health insurance paradigm. And finally, responsible economic development. You know, one of the things that we talk about with urban renewal, and it's happened generation after generation, is you take down low-income housing and you replace it with high-rise luxury condos, or you take open space or a brownfield, and when you redevelop it, it's not used to be beneficial for the people that live in that neighborhood. You're putting up something new. People just want clean housing. Or when you're putting in new streets, add a bike lane, things like that. You know, in Milwaukee, we have added new jobs around green jobs. We have a windmill factory that has been that's going to be built for electric generation. We have an electric train factory that's being built to increase our high-speed rail activity. So really, responsible economic development is coming to the realization that, especially in a place like Milwaukee, the old industries are gone and they're not coming back. So let's take a look at what's there for the future and that the future workforce will have an interest in working on and will fit with their ideals. So again, we're not saying scrap the public health model and start using this, but what we're saying is this next generation has expectations, and we can use transformational leadership in these hard budget times to help meet the expectations of our future workforce and make public health an attractive career endeavor for those young folks to pursue. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Questions, please.
For nursing positions, because the pay in government is half of what you could get working, you know, seven on, seven off at a hospital.
Right.
So maybe we can start looking at, you know, even our tech school getting a two-year health educator degree. Maybe it's more social workers and MSWs. If we're not going to be providing, in theory, in the future, as many immunizations or well baby checks or things that require clinical skills. Maybe the paradigm shift is to create a public health workforce that is based on a social work model and not a nursing model. As far as the mixed income housing, I think in Milwaukee it hasn't worked out really good yet because of the transportation issues, and we don't have a transportation infrastructure that makes living out in the suburbs or even out in the newer parts of town feasible. You know, the buses just don't run. The suburbs don't want the buses to run out there. We're having a hard time getting the downtown rail system even approved. When I come here and I see all these trains buzzing around, it's like, this is incredible, you know. But instead we have it where, you know, I drive in 8 miles and it's $140 a month to park my car. And that just is a deterrent for low income folks to live away from where things are walkable or bikeable.
I'd like to just follow up on that from a public health nursing faculty member and coming from.
Please don't take it personally. Please don't take it personally.
I am all for interdisciplinary models. I think that's absolutely crucial because no one discipline can do it all. But just because the argument that, or let's put another thing, because we can't attract public health nursing because of the salaries, that's not strong enough. But I would argue for assisting bringing up the salaries because they are absolutely the best. There was one session on the differences. The because public health nurses will bring something different, a stronger clinical preparation, environmental health focus, partnership, and all that. So I don't want public health nurses left aside. More nurses are being prepared with doctoral level degrees.
And that's something that we don't have, and that is, I don't think we're prepared to handle nurse practitioners or PAs or doctorally prepared nurses either right now. So, you know.
I'm not talking about clinical services.
Right.
That public health nurses do, but population based.
Yes.
Yes. Okay. So, in relation to your slide about the budget thing, so if Medicare and Medicaid reimbursements start going up and you have a decrease in clinical services, how are you going to fill it again?
I think that's the question. I mean, is healthcare reform, you know, there's a lot of money in there right now for preventive services, and you don't necessarily bill for health education, but there are grants for, you know, communities putting prevention to work, community transformation grants. How long those programs last, if they last into next year, is a question we'll have to have answered, but I don't have an answer. I don't know. Unless.
I'm thinking about things like contracting or privatizing, shifting clinical services from public health to, say, your managed care organization in the community. Then how is that going to be beneficial financially to the health department?
I just want to make a comment that on my soapbox, I'm personally encouraging the use of the preventive health dollars in the healthcare reform bill to be used for capacity building for state and local health departments in whatever context capacity they need, especially if it's for such basic infrastructure needs as in the workforce as purchasing epidemiologists, nurses, health educators, for the basic infrastructure so they can do whatever is needed in their community.
Well, one other thing I was thinking of too is, you know, we're talking about partnerships. One of the things that we're trying to do in Milwaukee is to write more research grants with our university, and, you know, we can provide access to programs and people. They can provide much more robust evaluations and research. So I think it might be more of that academic health department model. Another thing that I think is worth exploring would be a relationship with the insurance companies. Almost like, you know, they have to hit certain scores. You know, they have to show that they can vaccinate 85% of their patients that have their insurance, or they have to document that they have to see patients once or twice a year so that they can maintain their coverage. Oftentimes they don't hit their marks because they don't know where to find those folks. Those are the folks that come to our clinics and get the services. If we eliminate those clinics, which I'm not proposing that you do in the immediately, say, oh, healthcare reform passed, now you have insurance, go to a doctor. But if you can have a relationship with your local insurance companies or your healthcare systems to say, if you give us X $100,000, we will help you case manage your hardest to find populations. Or we will go out and find those people that don't come in for their immunization that have been coming to our clinic so you can, you know, it's mutually beneficial. Everybody gets their shots and you can hit your measures. I don't think it's necessarily selling out. I think it's using the resources available to satisfy our mission and fulfill the requirements of the insurance companies.
I just like to make a comment in your city. I don't know if all local health departments will do to kind of get away from the clinical services, because in some areas there is. You know, there is no HMO, there is no managed care, there's only one to provide those services. But then we do have to encourage our local health departments, with healthcare reform, if you want to see that clinical conduit, you're going to have to do reimbursement.
Yep.
You're going to have to embrace that Kaiser Permanente versus Blue Cross Blue Shield have different measures of reimbursement. And a lot of times they don't want to do the clinical services because they don't want to pay for other reimbursement. So that's something, if we're going to do clinical services and we're going to be that provider, we're going to have to embrace that as well. And just on your comment with the public health nurses, just to attract people to public health.
health, we may have to start looking at our community colleges as a gateway.
Right.
Introducing those individuals at the associate levels of public health, they go on for their bachelor's and they go on for their master's or doctorate or whatever, just to be able to increase the workforce, because people just typically aren't going straight for a BS in public health for those universities that offer it, or going for the MPH thereafter. So maybe we go to those community colleges as a gateway and introduce them to public health nursing and all those to bring them on the academic ladder.
They do have that for environmental health.
Right, environmental and a few others, but not across all the five major areas.
And I don't know about other communities, but in Milwaukee, to be a public health nurse, you have to have a BSN.
And that's written in the state.
Right, that's written. Yeah, so what I'm saying is, you know, we start you there at the associate, then we get you to go on for the BSN. We're increasing that.
But we don't have a work category to have those associate folks actually provide any services.
No, I'm not saying provide, I'm saying it's an academic gateway to say, look, the BSN is a career opportunity for.
It was here and then somebody over here was trying to ask something too, so.
I was just gonna comment on that too, as far as conversation about inclusion of, say, medical assistants and things of that nature in the public health and clinical side of public health, not to replace nursing, but to alleviate some of the burden.
Yes.
The nurses were so used to the outbreak, you know, the epic and all that. So if there's medical assistants do the basic, like,
yep, in Wisconsin anyway. Yeah.
What do you think the role of the local health department is going to be in achieving, you know, the triple aim? We already did the population health, and then there's healthcare quality improvement that, you know, we want to, Berwick, you know, wants to go for. And then cost of care. And I kind of like to also think about cost of prevention. I'm thinking that the epidemiologists, in at least in our rural, large city, I'm thinking that our epi department, to be even be able to play with the rest of, you know, with these healthcare systems, is going to have to really be beefed up, because I've actually had one of the large health system CEOs say, public health doesn't have the infrastructure to do all of these assessments properly, and everything. We're just going to do it ourselves. What's your reaction to that?
Well, I don't know what your state is doing, but, you know, there's...
very little.
And you're in Indiana, right?
Yeah.
We have, in Wisconsin, we have a health information exchange, at least in Milwaukee, that all the health systems contribute to in the emergency department. So we use that for monitoring communicable disease outbreaks and what chief complaints are showing up in the emergency room. They're also putting in inpatient data so we can take a look at where patients, you know, who's utilizing the hospitals. But this information exchange is actually being funded by private insurance companies, because it saves them money by reducing, you know, multiple prescriptions or and things of that nature. So that's a partnership that is using data to drive population health interventions. You know, it was what we used to predict or to track H1N1. How many people are going to the emergency room?
Yeah. We did that too. We have information exchange
right.
as well.
And so then, so the way I see it is,
but I mean, as far as the analysis of all of that data to do what you're talking about in the context, you know, if you break down into, you know, you have all of these community organizations, or coalitions, I should say, that will need to be formed, I think, in health so that, you know, we get improvements in population.
Well, it might not be that the health department has the epidemiologists on staff, but in partnership with your local university, they can be, you know, we, in Milwaukee, what we're trying to do is have a joint faculty appointments. My position is that way. I work a day and a half a week at the School of Public Health in Milwaukee. So we're trying to, you know, link that expertise with our practice to allow us to analyze data, use their IT infrastructure, all of those sorts of things. So it might not be a health department's responsibility, but it may be providing a mutually beneficial proposal to your local university to have them be your data analysts and help you craft the reports at the end of studies.
Are there any other questions? Excellent discussion. Thank you all for coming.
Thank you.